And welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland sitting in today for Carl Gerke, who is on vacation for the next week or so. And joining me now is Davia Nelson. She is known as one of the Kitchen Sisters. Davia, thanks for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So Hidden Kitchens is a new program heard on Morning Edition. Tell us a little bit about Hidden Kitchens.
Yes, it's a series about secret, unexpected, below-the-radar cooking, how communities come together through food. And maybe your listeners recall a few years back we did a long season of Hidden Kitchen Stories, and now we've brought it back to Morning Edition, and this season is Hidden Kitchens World. It's global stories of the transformative power of food. I would say to your friends in South Dakota, too, I'm in San Francisco. Our offices are in North Beach in Francis Coppola's film building, and there's a ton of construction going on right outside my window. So if you're hearing it, South Dakota, you're just hearing San Francisco building more skyscrapers.
That's all right, all right. So let's talk a little bit about how important the tradition of food is.
I think food is what we all have in common. And there are so few things these days that we all have in common. Food is the universal language we all eat. And I think we took on the Hidden Kitchens idea in part because music and food, they are such universals and such things that bring people together. And using food as a kind of a lens, as a prism, we're able to look at so many other issues in the culture, whether it's homelessness or social justice or generations or in the environment. Underneath food are all these, you know, stories of families, immigration, and food is this sort of window and portal into all that as well. And food is love. I mean, I notice with all these people involved with food, there's this theme of generosity and kind of a compassion with so many of them. The people drawn to making and cooking food on these levels are some of the most connected community people that there are.
Do you ever, does it ever happen where the stories just start sounding the same? Or are they always
with
different?
With food? Well, yeah. I mean, because it's food and there is
right.
story about
And we
food.
All come together around food, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we try to look for example, in this season of Hidden Kitchens, we started with, the first story was called The Pizza Connection, and it's about fighting the mafia through food. And that story was in Sicily, and it was about a group called Libera Terra who make wine and olive oil, organic wine, organic olive oil, on confiscated mafia lands. And they're trying to recreate the economy of Sicily, which has been devastated by the mafia, and bring new employment. And when I said, why, you know, they're taking these confiscated lands and going organic, it's already hard enough to begin these new businesses. And they said, I said, why organic? And they said, because our land and our souls have been so poisoned by the mafia, we have to begin again and cleanse. So that's one story. The next story in the series was about turnspit dogs in medieval England. And there, they were always obsessed with cooking big, large joints of meat, spit roasting. And in the beginning, they used small boys, sort of orphan boys, to turn these spits hours and hours and hours. And then there started to be movements against child labor. And they decided, oh, I know, we'll have dogs do it instead. And they built wooden wheels. And these dogs, for hours and hours, would run and turn these spits. And we wound up, and they were also in the United States for a while. Benjamin Franklin in his Gazette has advertisements for dog wheels. And they were in the hotels of Manhattan, these dog wheels turning these large spits, which were there until the mechanization of spit roasting. But it led to the founding of the ASPCA, this treatment of dogs. And then we moved into Russia, communal kitchens and dissident kitchens of the Soviet Union. So I think depending on how you tell food stories, you're telling the story of a culture and a history and of so much more than just food.
And how is it, Davia, for you to find the history, to find the backstory? Is it factually based, or is it, you know, the stories that are also handed down?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. I mean, we spend so much time, as you say, just following that oral tradition from one storyteller to the next, from one grandmother to the next, from across generations. But then we're also always trying to make sure that the stories we're telling are based in fact. So we're doing tons of research in archives and talking to professors and talking to historians and anthropologists and, you know, cookbook writers, as well as the, you know, children of the owners of the Turnspit dogs, and, you know, went for that story. For example, we went to the Kennel Club in London. We went back to Wales and to the last museum that has an actual Turnspit dog stuffed in a case, taxidermied, and the old inns in England that where there still were cooking wheels. And so you're always on a mixture of oral tradition and facts that you gather, and then finding the person that can give voice to that. And also we're always gathering music everywhere we go, so we're always looking for the people that can capture the story and the times in song as well.
Tell me a little bit about your process and how you find these people and these stories.
Well, for example, the Dissident Kitchen story in Moscow in the Soviet Union, I was in Moscow a few years ago and having lunch at a place called the Pizza Patio in Moscow, an Italian restaurant in Moscow, with this phenomenal writer and television host that someone had introduced me to. And I said to him, "Mr. Arafayev, what is your hidden kitchen?" And he looked at me and he said, "It is dissident kitchens. The whole Soviet Union fell apart because of the kitchen." And I was like, whoa, that's, hadn't thought of it that way. You know, what did this man mean? How huge was the role of the kitchen that one of the great thinkers of that country would say such a thing? And so then we began to follow and trace down what that idea was, what he really meant by that. It turned out, for example, that there was all this forbidden Western music and literature and Soviet writers. And in the kitchens of that country, after people moved out of these communal apartments and got their own private apartments, which had private kitchens for the first time after generations after Stalin's death, when Nikita Khrushchev came into power, he said he built all these apartment buildings, and now people had their own private kitchen for the first time in years. And all these new ideas started to flourish in kitchens because there was some privacy, and people could talk honestly one to another and say their own ideas and type secret novels and record new music, perform new music. Kitchens became sort of nightclubs and art galleries and dating services, and they were where the whole culture flourished. So we just kept tracking that. Then we would find the singers that sang songs about that, and we found that there were plays about this. We started finding old recordings of these wonderful, like the Bob Dylan of Russia, of the Soviet Union, found his old recordings, and you just start layering them up. We probably, for each 7-minute story you hear on Morning Edition, we probably gather about 30 hours of tape.
30 hours of tape.
Yeah, we're nuts.
No, to me that seems about right.
And they're very, yeah. if your listeners are hearing them, next time you hear one, there's one coming up on Tuesday called The Romance and Sex Life of the Date. It's from the Coachella Valley in California. It's how the date industry came to be. There were these agricultural explorers in the 1800s who went in search of new crops to plant in the United States. This is how the mango and the avocado and the Meyer lemon came to be here, and dates were also that. And, you know, we just, once we hear about a story, we also feel like we're doing these stories in the immediate for Morning Edition or All Things Considered and NPR, but they're deep archives of oral histories that hopefully other people will make use of and do other kinds of stories with. We make use of other people's archives often in telling our stories. We hope someone uses ours.
When you say you have 30 hours of tape that and you archive it, you archive all of it, make all of it available, or just the 7 minutes that you produce?
No, we try to put up our original raw interviews, too. And we're trying to. There's a wonderful archive called Pop-Up Archive that's just started. And we're trying to put up as much of our long interviews, because there's thousands of stories within our 30 hours, not just the ones we're telling. And then we're trying to also slowly but surely get these transcriptions done of them, too, so that researchers or anyone who's interested mm-hmm. could look at that and see what they, you know, are interested in finding out about. And in our stories, you know, we have a lot of interview, we have a lot of music, we have archival audio, field recordings. They're deeply layered and really textured, and we're kind of almost every time you're listening to one thing, you're listening to two things. There's, we're always trying to convey the story in almost a third dimension, as if, or like they're small films where you could really visualize the stories we're telling.
Do you do a visual as well? Do you take pictures and video?
Yeah, we are always videotaping uh-huh. and photographing as we go. Yeah. Some of the stories that we tell are from, you know, deep past time, and so, you know, we're looking for historic engravings or old illustrations, photographs of another time and place. But yes, we are. And if you go to kitchensisters.org, or if you go to npr.org and go to the blog called The Salt, you can see a lot of extra material behind each of these stories, as well as a written version of it as well.
And how often are you eating the food during your interviews?
What a great question. I'll tell you why, because we almost never get to eat the food. You would think we would just be feasting as we go, but once you start recording, it's really hard to eat when you're recording. You know, you've got a mm-hmm. microphone, tape recorder, you're moving around, you're chronicling the sound of the cooking, the roar of the fire. And if you start eating, you're distracted and you start hearing that sound and people start serving you. And it's just, and no one really wants to see someone eat and record. So they ask you, you know, they just feel like it's uncomfortable. So you kind of feel awkward to keep recording while you're doing it. So it's crazy. I mean, we've recorded so many big church suppers and burgoo festivals and all kinds of things. And we're lucky if we taste it at the very, very end. It's crazy.
Because you shouldn't talk with your mouth full, right?
Yes, and often, yes, exactly. And often people put aside, I've noticed, plates of food for us as we're doing our work. And then at the end, when the whole thing's done and we stop recording, we go back to find that plate and someone will have thrown it out because it was just sitting somewhere getting cold and they didn't know it was for us. So, you know, we have to just eat the audio instead.
Do you have a favorite? Do you have an absolute favorite food story?
You know, the favorite is hard. I mean, so many of them touch me for so many different reasons. But the story that we did, I don't know if you ever heard, it was called An Unexpected Kitchen, the George Foreman Grill. And mm-hmm. it was one of the first stories that we did in the Hidden Kitchen series about homeless people and new immigrants, but especially homeless people, using George Foreman grills on the streets to cook and to get a hot meal. And people with no kitchen and no place to do it, and finding old, beat-up George Foreman grills and plugging into power poles and being able to cook. And we heard about that, and we just thought, oh, my God, we never thought of an appliance as a hidden kitchen. And then our second thought was, does George Foreman know? And we tracked George Foreman down and wound up talking to him and telling him the story, and he had no idea. And then he told us his life story, which was a story of hunger and poverty and kind of starvation and all that hunger leading to all this rage and anger, which led to him becoming a fighter. Hello?
I'm still here. Are you here?
Oh, okay, good.
So okay, go ahead.
There was another voice. A hungry voice on the other end. Anyway, that story, I would say, is one that really lingers for me. It's on. You can hear it at kitchensisters.org or npr.org. And then Georgia Gilmore and the Club from Nowhere, about a secret civil rights kitchen in the South during the Montgomery bus boycott. It was the first integrated dining spot. It was hidden in this woman's home. And her story just, we say with the food stories, it's like who glues your community together through food. I wonder if I asked you that, who would that be in your community? Who glues South Dakota together through food?
That's a tough one.
Maybe somebody listening will tell us.
I guess my guess would most likely be, your church basement potlucks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I'm sure. And there's probably, how many people use food as a way to raise money, whether it's a spaghetti feed or a barbecue or, like you say, a church supper, a fish
fry. Or your summer festivals, those kinds of traditional food festivals that happen in the summers in South Dakota. That would be another
one. Do you have food trucks, a food truck movement going on where you are?
Yes, some. And were food giveaways, you mean, from food trucks?
Well, like in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York and other places, too, I'm sure, these coaches, food, where people are cooking food on trucks and moving through different communities. They started out as taco trucks, but now there's Korean food and Indian food. And one in our community is called Adobo Agogo, which is Filipino food. You know, and there's now people who can't, especially with the economy being what it is, many people can't afford to open a restaurant, but they can afford a food truck, and they start that way, and they build up their clientele and build up their business and slowly but surely work their way into having the following to be able to open a restaurant, especially different ethnic communities.
I'll have to look into that. I think there might be in the summer in downtown Sioux Falls, but not a whole lot. But, plus we have a lot of food co-ops and that kind of thing, too.
The
baskets.
Yeah, we say, who are the local kitchen pioneers and visionaries, and what are the rites and rituals around food? I mean, maybe your listeners will tell us. I'd love to hear Hidden Kitchen South Dakota.
There you go. We will keep you posted. But Davia, thank you so much for taking the time and being on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, such a pleasure. And we look forward to hearing from you.